What is up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the FanCast Movies Podcast. My name is Eric Davis. Joining me, as always, is Mr. Sean O'Connell. What's up, Sean?
Hey, Eric. I promised at some point we're going to stop talking about Gravity, but this isn't the moment. We're going to talk about it a little bit more because it is a huge movie, a genre-defining movie. A film that I think sets the bar for science fiction for years to come, and it was a huge blockbuster weekend, so we need to keep talking about it for at least one more podcast.
We need to keep talking about it for at least one more podcast. For those of you not familiar with our little podcast here, we run it on Fandango.com. It's also on Movies.com. Sean and I are on Twitter as well. You can follow us there. And this podcast is also on iTunes. So search for the FanCast Movies Podcast, and you will find it. The links, of course, are in this post. Sean, talking about Gravity. Gravity made crazy money. We knew it was going to. I think it's one of the biggest 3D movies ever made now in terms of box office. It did bonkers money for 3D. It proves that 3D is still kind of a thing with audiences when a film sort of sells you on it big time. I think, I feel like we hear all these stories, is 3D dying? Is nobody wants to see 3D movies anymore? But then you see films like this come along, and all of a sudden, boom, 3D is big again. And it's got to drive the studios nuts because they don't know what to do with this 3D trend. But it goes to show you that if you make a film for 3D and people dig it, then 3D is still popular. And Gravity now puts the pressure on a lot of films coming up because you say we call it a benchmark film.
Right, exactly. And we have a number of sci-fi films that are on the horizon where I know I turned that off. Where they're going to be having to address the fact that Gravity has raised the bar for the types of storytelling that you tell. And I'm looking at, two major franchises that are going to have to deal with telling stories in outer space, and it's Star Wars Episode 7 and it's Marvel's Guardians of the Galaxy. And you were able to get an early look at some Guardians stuff, and we think that it's going to be one of the first Marvel stories, the standalone Marvel stories, that are going to take place almost entirely in outer space in another galaxy. We know Thor goes to Asgard, but for the most part, in Kenneth Branagh's first film, he was in New Mexico too, on what was a very small set. And Marvel seems to be laying the foundation for telling multiple stories in outer space. If Thanos is going to be a villain the way that they tease, if Doctor Strange is going to be a character. So if I'm people like J.J. Abrams or James Gunn or, Christopher Nolan's going to do a science fiction film with Interstellar that's going to be all about wormholes and time travel, don't you think that these filmmakers are looking at what Alfonso Cuarón has done in Gravity and all of a sudden realizing, like, holy cow, I have to at least bring my feature up to that level? Because to me, it seems like most of these films and science fiction for at least the next few years are going to be compared either favorably or negatively to what Gravity did, in much the same way that when Avatar came out, everybody was like, wow, if you're going to do 3D, it has to look like Avatar now, or else it's just not going to be satisfactory, and we might not want to pay to see what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult with Gravity, because Gravity, I think, takes a more realistic approach than, say, Star Wars or Guardians of the Galaxy. I mean, Guardians of the Galaxy has a raccoon that fires a machine gun. Unfortunately, there was no raccoon that fires a machine gun in Gravity. That would have been a memorable scene.
That we know of.
If Alfonso Cuarón put that in, here comes a floating raccoon to take out George Clooney's character. But, it's hard to kind of compare them. It's hard to watch Star Wars and be like, oh, they didn't do this. I think if in terms of what you're watching Gravity for, what these filmmakers should pay attention to is the way that it holds your attention and it holds sort of all of your emotions hostage for the entire film. That's what I really loved about Gravity the most, is just how it goes from – I mean, you really don't have a moment to breathe in this film.
So for you, it's not even science fiction. It was more the story than anything. It could have been set, say, at sea and maybe been the same film.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the effects that we're talking about, a lot of these groundbreaking benchmark effects aren't going to come into play in a film like Star Wars or Guardians of the Galaxy. It's not really going to. I mean, I think some of the way they film being in space is really cool, and I think that they could look at that and apply that to their own films. But I really think, the way Cuarón sort of holds the audience hostage and injects them right into the world from the minute we go, I think that's something that people should – should pay attention to.
I'm sorry, finish.
And I know that in terms of these long one shots and these you know, that Kieran is famous for and that he really builds into his films, and I really cannot say anything about this at all, but I will say that similar approaches are being made to Guardians of the Galaxy, and I think that I already think that filmmakers are kind of watching and seeing what works and what doesn't, and I think it's going to be really cool.
That's interesting. All right. I think that there is a film that's going to be indirectly compared to Gravity, unfortunately, and it's Ender's Game, which comes out in November and does have a lot of special effects, science fiction special effects. A lot of it takes place in outer space, and I do think that I'll at least be interested to read the narrative, you know, when that film comes out, to see if people are saying, oh, well, it doesn't quite look as good as the outer space scenes that we saw in Gravity. Or maybe they'll just treat it as a completely standalone, different film and won't get compared. But, you know, quite often we run into situations where we have two different movies that are very similar, two volcano movies, two asteroid movies. They happen to hit in the same year and one does, you know, better than the other. I'm not saying that Gravity is going to really, you know, stack up against Ender's Game or vice versa, but I will be curious to see how, when that film finally arrives, how audiences respond to it and whether they even bring up Gravity at all as a comparison, or if they just decide to treat it as its own thing, its own adaptation of Orson Scott Card's novel.
Yeah, you know, that's what I'm most interested in as we move far and farther away from Gravity, is how does this movie land with audiences as we get months and years in the future? You know, we live in a society today where I feel like it is so dominated by a 24-hour news cycle, and we forget things the weekend after we see them, and it's harder and harder for movies to really leave their mark on kind of popular culture in general. You know, Gravity had a major weekend, but is this a film now that's going to go down in those record books? Is this a film now that's going to go down in your memory as one of your most memorable movie-going experiences? Or are we going to get into early November with Ender's Game and Thor the Dark World, and people are going to already forget about Gravity? I'm curious to see whether or not this film leaves its mark.
Well, it left its mark on a certain filmmaker who we both like a lot, and that's Quentin Tarantino. And I want to transition into our next topic, which is Tarantino put out a list. This is kind of odd, too. Tarantino put out a list of his top 10 movies of the year so far, Gravity being one of them. It doesn't land anywhere near the top, which I was a little bit surprised at. And I'm also shocked that he's putting out a list in October, you know, when there's still several more months to go and plenty more films that could possibly contend. But Tarantino tends to do this every year. He puts together a list of films that he's been really moved by. We know he watches a ton of films, and Gravity for him landed at number 7. Were you surprised that it landed that far down?
I am surprised that it landed that far down, you know, but then again, Tarantino's a fan of conversation.
Right.
And Gravity doesn't have a lot of conversation in it. And if you look at the at least the top three films that he has,
right,
are very kind of character-driven conversational movies. Afternoon Delight, which is a small indie film that premiered at Sundance, is his top one. I don't think many people saw that at all.
I saw it. And I liked it. It was okay, but I would not have ever guessed that anyone, let alone Tarantino, would put it as their number one film of the year. It has a really interesting performance by Catherine Hahn, who's known as a comedian, often a foul-mouthed comedian who pops up in, you know, Will Ferrell, Paul Rudd-type comedies, and she shows that she's capable of a lot more, but I wouldn't have put it at the top of a list like this, no.
I mean, but yeah, when I look at, like, at least his top six, right, The Conjuring comes in at number 4, so that let's set that aside. But if you look, then we have Before Midnight at number 2, we have Blue Jasmine at number 3, we have Drinking Buddies at number 5, we have Frances Ha at number 6. Mm-hmm. These are all indie movies, conversational movies, character-driven movies, and you know, you look at kind of the, you know, and now as my phone rings, this is the podcast of ringing phones. You know,
drink when our phones ring.
We are, yeah. That's if you're playing along at home and drinking during this podcast, which we would
Recommend.
Drink every time one of our phone rings. But yeah, you know, if you look at these films, they're all conversational films and character-driven films, and that's kind of what Tarantino likes to do with his films.
But they're not bloody films. They're not violent films. They're not genre recreations, which Tarantino tends to do. You know, Kick-Ass 2 lands at number 8. That feels to me like a Tarantino-type movie. Let's talk about number 9 on the list, which I think everyone is shocked at. He puts Gore Verbinski's The Lone Ranger as number 9 on his a list of the top 10 films of 2013 so far. And you talk about being surprised that Afternoon Delight is at the top. I mean, I'm shocked that Lone Ranger is on this list at all. Even its most passionate defenders, and there are a few of them out there who thought that they, you know, that what Gore Verbinski was trying to do worked. I don't think that they would ever put it on a top 10 list so far. I wonder what struck him about Lone Ranger that made him include it on this list.
Yeah, and you also wonder exactly how many films Tarantino has seen throughout the year.
He saw 10.
he saw 10 films. These are his 10 favorite. But, you know, it's – yeah, you know, I would be curious. And I'm sure we'll get an explanation down the line, because as soon as someone has a chance to talk to him, you know they're going to say, oh, so you're top 10, The Lone Ranger. What's up? What's up with that? And he'll tell you why it struck a nerve with him. And it could not – and maybe it's not just the film itself. Maybe it's a scene. Maybe it's a moment. Maybe it's the way they pulled something off that he really liked. But, you know, it just goes to show that even if you're one of the most prolific and well-known filmmakers in the world, your tastes may not just directly go towards the best of the best. You know, you may just kind of find stuff that – but we all have those movies. We all have those movies that nobody likes or other people don't like that you find something to like about. So, I mean, you can't – you know, you can't say that he's whack or he's completely out of touch with reality. But, you know, because maybe he did find something that he really, really liked in The Lone Ranger. And
he does love Westerns.
He does. Yeah, exactly. He does love Westerns. And so maybe he liked the way they did it.
Well, I don't know if he loves Tom Hanks, and I don't know if he loves ripped from the headlines true life stories, but maybe Captain Phillips will make his revised list. Captain Phillips coming to theaters this week. Paul Greengrass teaming up with Tom Hanks for the first time to tell the story of Somali pirates taking over a cargo ship, working its way through very difficult waters. This film played at the New York Film Festival. It started screening even before the Toronto Film Festival for select critics, because I think that Sony feels that they've got an awards contender on their hands. Even though Tom Hanks is going to be sort of competing for Saving Mr. Banks, the Disney film later on this year, too, he may be in two categories for all we know, Best Actor, Best Supporting Actor. But Paul Greengrass is taking a story that's pretty familiar to a lot of us and trying to put a dramatic spin on it. I was able to see it, Eric. I don't think you've seen it yet, have you?
I have not seen it. But you have seen it, and I think we're going to – and one of the interesting things that I saw a 60 Minutes piece on it on Sunday, and I feel like I've seen the whole movie now. But one of the interesting things about these sorts of films that are based on real life stories is they can go either way. They can go the way where we're very, very familiar with the story, or we're not so familiar with the story. And I'm curious to have a quick conversation with you now about which ones do you sit more well with you. And let's provide examples, I think, of films that do each one of those really well, that tackle those sorts of circumstances exceptionally well.
Yeah, I never really knew if I had a preference, and I still don't know if I do. I think I like to go to the film, whether it's based on a true life story or whether it's based on fiction, I like to not know where the story's going, you know? And so I like to, if it's a story based on, you know, an existing event, I like to not, hopefully not be familiar with what's going to occur. Because what happened with Captain Phillips, and, you know, it's a great movie. It's a well-told movie. Tom Hanks is very good in it. Paul Greengrass obviously is a fantastic director. He has a very unique style that he uses with handheld cameras, and it's very intense, and it's riveting, and Captain Phillips is all of these things. But I felt like I knew the story well enough that as I watched it unfold, by the time I got to the end of it, I was like, yep, that was exactly what happened. And, you know, you see these promotional images of Tom Hanks standing with, you know, the actual Captain Phillips, So you know that you know, Captain Phillips is going to make it till the end of the movie. So there's all the suspense of whether he's how in danger is he, and when the Navy SEALs have to interfere, is he going to get shot in the process? And you're supposed to wring all the suspense out of is his life in danger? And I think there's a danger. But there's a danger of, you know, when you know the result and you know that someone involved in a real life story is going to make it, it takes a little bit of the emphasis off of the picture. It takes a little bit of that oomph away. And yet, if I were to pick a film that I thought handled an actual event or real life situations the most effectively, it's Greengrass's own film, United 93. And I'm really trying to, I have been since I saw Captain Phillips, try and figure out in my own brain why Greengrass's approach to the events on September 11th, and specifically the events in the plane, in the United 93 plane, held me so captive, and yet the story of Captain Phillips didn't quite hook me in the way that that did. And I think part of it might just be that we know the overlying events of September 11th, but we don't know for sure exactly what happened, like in the minds and the emotions of the people who were on that plane. And so watching these people try and find the courage to fight back against their temporary captors, to me was such a riveting movie going experience. And same director and same sort of approach to real life events, but for whatever reason, United 93 worked better for me than Captain Phillips does.
Yeah, I think United 93 were probably more emotionally connected to these people.
Yeah.
These are us. These are our neighbors on this plane. And it's just a story. I mean, just 9/11 in general, anything that you really put out that's related to that, even though we know exactly what happened, it still kind of captivates you.
And he didn't put you, though. He didn't, like, plunge you into the Twin Towers. I think one of the most affecting shots in the film is, like, in the air traffic control room, where you see, like, the smoke from the towers way in the distance. Like, he's not trying to tell that story. Mm-hmm. But the way that he frames it, you know, he's able to – we're in the moment of the day again, but we're reacting the way people who were, you know – caught by surprise that day or trying to get ahead of the situation again, and it was really difficult for them to do that.
I'm just excited to watch a movie where Tom Hanks is on a boat and he's not talking to a volleyball the whole time. I mean, is that so much to ask for?
No, that's fine.
When it comes to movies,
you'll get a lot out of Captain Phillips just for that reason.
but you know what? I like Tom Hanks. I like Tom Hanks in these sorts of movies. And I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to go see it this weekend, I think. I'm kind of upset I didn't get to see it.
Watching the film, I actually was terrified sitting there thinking that right now, as I'm sitting in this comfortable theater, there are men who are on these boats trying to get cargo from one difficult place to another. And, you know, part of the narrative of this film is that they're constantly looking out for pirates, who are coming after their freight, essentially. And so there are all of these tactics that they have in place. There are hoses hooked up around their boats that they can blast away at the pirate. Like 50% of their job isn't just, you know, transporting cargo. It's protecting that cargo from actual pirates. And I felt dread in my heart thinking that there are people doing this right now.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's
at this moment.
That's kind of cool because you don't know that. You know, you always drive over these bridges and you pass by these rivers and you always see these giant – in New York City, I see it all the time, these giant cargo ships just kind of sitting there. And every time you pass one of these, you always look at it and you wonder, like, who's on that thing? What are they doing right now?
Right.
And to know that most of their journey involves them looking, keeping an eye out for pirates that are going to literally come stay. I mean, in this day and age, pirates, we're talking about different kinds of pirates. But it's interesting, and it goes to show you just how fascinating their job really is. You see these ships that are just sitting there with all these crates on it. You're like, oh, that's got to be a boring job. But it ain't so boring, and I think this movie proves that.
Well, and he says to his shipmates at one point, when it seems like they're actually going to get attacked, he's like, you know what you signed up for. You know, this is part of the job, and you took this on, and you sort of gamble. You know, you roll the dice of like, hey, maybe this time we won't get attacked by pirates. But in this particular instance, they were. You had an example, though, of a film based on actual events that took a different approach. Is that right?
I did. I didn't tell you this before we started. I didn't tell you the film, even though you asked me the film.
I did.
Because I tend to be driven towards real life stories that I'm not as familiar with. One of those was Catch Me If You Can.
Steven Spielberg. See, now that's a great example.
And I love this film. And I didn't know who Frank Abagnale Jr. was. I didn't know his story about how he kind of conned his way with millions of dollars and ran around the country and did all sorts, got himself in all sorts of these situations. But I just love the way they told that story. I think Leonardo DiCaprio is brilliant in it. There's some fantastic direction. It's one of these Spielberg movies that it comes up in conversation, but is sort of after his E.T.s and his Jurassic Parks and his Indiana Jones, you know, down the line. But it is one of my favorite Spielberg movies.
And a different side of Tom Hanks also.
And a different side of Tom Hanks. That, you know, that's funny. I didn't even think about the fact that Tom Hanks is connected to Captain Phillips and Catch Me If You Can. But yeah, and a different side of Tom Hanks. And just a film that sort of takes a real life story that you're not as familiar with and makes it larger than life and really, really entertaining. That's one that I just love the hell out of when people talk about real life stories on film.
And you're right. You don't get hooked into the – you don't get caught up in the details of saying, oh, well, you know, Frank Abagnale was definitely not like this. And you start to nitpick. And there wasn't too much of his life that needed to be told. It was a perfect little standalone story. It's not like when DiCaprio did, you know, The Aviator with Martin Scorsese, and there was so much, you know, life to sort of capture, and you could pick and choose your moment. Like, I watched a documentary about Muhammad Ali recently, and it was – there's so many aspects of that guy's life that you could focus on, you know, that it feels like singling out one or two stories, you're not doing enough justice to it. And same thing with Captain Phillips. Like, this is what this man is known for specifically. This is what he's – quote unquote famous for, and this is his story that needed to be told. I'm not saying that it shouldn't have been told. I just wonder if it was so close to the actual events that it's all still fresh in our minds, and the footage of the standoff with the boat and the Navy SEALs, and you know, Greengrass really knows how to pull it onto the big screen, but I just feel like we just saw it recently, so I wonder if that's going to work against the film.
Well, I guess we could both agree, though, that if you saw Gravity last weekend and you're looking to kind of keep that rush, you're looking to ride that rush, you could go see Rush, which is still in theaters. But you should see Captain Phillips, too, because it's another one of those kind of intense movies, which feels like October and late September is full of these films. We still have 12 Years a Slave kind of coming on the horizon, too, which is a movie that really sort of freaking knocks the wind out of you.
Yeah.
But I think that people who would dig in on Gravity, who want to keep riding that rush, can go see Captain Phillips and be satisfied. They could go see a movie about a man who unfortunately does not exist in real life, because if we did have a real life machete. Life would be a lot more interesting.
He probably would have gone into Captain Phillips' ship and dispersed with those pirates in bloody fashion. I did not see Machete Kills, Eric, but I want you to justify why Robert Rodriguez is able to keep cranking out these sequels. I know he keeps them under budget and he keeps working with the same people, but is his audience going to come out for Machete Kills?
I think they should. I think if you're any kind of grindhouse fan, exploitation fan, you know, if you've seen Machete, the first one, you kind of know what to expect. I had a really fun time with this film. Yes, I saw it at Fantastic Fest, which is a place where if you're going to see a film like this, you want to see it at Fantastic Fest. To give you an example of what they did, there's a moment in this film where somebody threatens to stick a popsicle up someone's rear end. And at that moment at Fantastic Fest, they passed out chocolate popsicles to the entire audience. So, you know, those sorts of experience do heighten a movie for you. But, you know, I like Machete. I think it was Machete Kills. I think it was a little long for this kind of film. But it's long in the right places. If we're spending more time with Mel Gibson's ridiculous supervillain, who comes with his own theme song and diabolical plan to take over the world – then I'm okay with that. Yes, you know, if we are jonesing for more Mel Gibson, he is just fantastic in this film as the supervillain.
That's exactly who I was going to ask you about.
Yeah. Like
Mel Gibson is putting himself now in a position where the only way he's getting work is if he's sort of lampooning who he used to be. He's an Expendables 3 villain. He's the Machete Kills villain. Can he continue to do this? Or are these little stepping stones to us maybe possibly accepting Mel Gibson as a screen presence again? And and him being able to do actual films, because at one point he was a very respected director, and of course one of the biggest stars, you know, working in films, and not just bloody action films like Braveheart. You know, he was doing legitimate dramas, he was doing romantic comedies, and I don't know if we can accept him as that, but is he only going to be a cartoonish villain from here on out, or does he have potential to maybe grow back into an actor that we're paying to see?
I think he has the potential. It's just a matter of whether or not he wants it, you know. Okay. But I loved him in this movie. If there's anything, and we have to do wrap it up, but if there's anything that I love the most about this film is that it has the most creative use of an ensemble cast in 2013. Okay. There's one assassin character called the Chameleon, who's sort of, yeah, he's an assassin, kind of bounty hunter sort of character, but the chameleon aspect of it is the character is played by five different actors, one of which is Lady Gaga, and it's really fun to see how this one character is sort of embodied by all these different actors. And it's really, really cool.
And Charlie Sheen is the president of the United
Charlie
States?
Charlie Sheen is basically playing himself if Charlie Sheen was the president of the United States. And yeah, I mean, it's just campy, all-out campness, funny, silly, a lot of creative kills that involve helicopters. This is what you're looking for. If you've seen Machete, I did not see the first Machete, if you want to know. And I just went in blind to Machete Kills and really liked it. Had a good time with it. See it with an audience. See it with a large, you know, large midnight crowd, you know, like an audience that's kind of ramped up for it. And I think you'll get more out of the film. But yeah, I recommend it. If you're seeing the commercials with sexy on it, that's my quote, because it is sexy. There's a lot of hottie patatis, as they would say in my neck of the woods.
Nobody says that.
I say hottie patatis because I have kids, Sean. I have kids. I have to kidicize my language sometimes. And if I do want to say, oh wow, that's a really hot looking, you know, mama, I have to say hottie patati.
Well, we're podcasting from 1940. We hope you join us next week, where we're going to talk about the talkies coming to theaters.
We are going to talk about the talkies. One of those talkies is the Carrie remake. I promise next week that our phones will go off a lot more, so yes, you can get a lot drunker as you listen to this podcast and take a shot every time one of our phones goes off in the background. Sean O'Connell, thank you very much for joining me again this week. I will see you next week, and we will talk about some of those films, and Carrie and horror remakes in October. We're in October. Carrie is like the only horror movie arriving in theaters, but it's not the only movie that's getting your heart rate up, because we do have Gravity, Captain Phillips, 12
and Years the horrors of 12 Years a Slave, the horrors of American slavery, which I think will be more terrifying than any Paranormal Activity film.
I guarantee you that would be the scariest horror movie you see in October this year. Sean O'Connell, thank you very much. You can subscribe on iTunes, listen on Fandango, on Movies, follow us on Twitter, the whole shebang. You know what to do. Thank you very much for listening. Comment away and enjoy your weekend at the movies.